Good afternoon and welcome to Lunch with Leaders. I'm Cindy Morgan, the Vice President of Learning and Organizational Development, and I am so happy you're here. Thanks so much for joining us. As you know, Lunch with Leaders is where we come together in community and share with our fellow leaders. We're really hoping that you learn as much from each other in the chat and share your own knowledge in the chat as much as you do from my esteemed guests. So just want to remind you, all of our back episodes can be found on the Lead Strong webpage. Make sure you're telling your friends. So, welcome back. We're live. It feels like forever that we've been gone and I've really missed you. I hope you're all doing really well. Are you like me? Are you scratching your head saying, how is it September already? Where did the summer go? I feel like it was just couple of days ago where I was singing, see you in September, and now here we all are. Where has the time gone? So tell me everything. I want to hear in the chat, what'd you do during your Lunch with Leaders hiatus? Did you go on vacation? Did you have any self-care plans? I'd love any highlights that you'd like to share with us in community. I know and I'm confident that at least one of you is going to say that ABBA being on TikTok was like the highlight of summer 2021. Let me hear from you in the chat. How'd you spend your summer vacation, if you did? While you're putting your highlights of the summer in the chat, I am going to circle back to where we last left off in July. Feels like a lifetime ago, and in COVID years, that's literally 29 years ago, even though it was just a couple of short weeks ago. You may remember, our last show was 5 tips for driving internal communications with Debbie Foster, Sarah Johnson, and Dr. Sean Grady. If you happen to miss the show, go back and catch it. It is an excellent one. The love was strong from the participants as well as from the community. Great feedback. Here are some of the comments. Got a shout out to one of our internal communications gurus herself, Dinah Schuster. Dinah thought the show was great, and she does this all day, every day. So if she got something out of it, I'm sure all of us can look at it again and get something out of it. So if you missed it again, Lead Strong webpage, it's a great one to watch with your team and discuss as well. So I'll tell you a little bit about what we did on our break. We thought a lot about Lunch with Leaders, believe it or not. I know you believe us because we do think about the show a lot. And we just kind of kept rolling over in our minds and contemplating ways that we could keep this show fresh for the fall. It's like our whole theme, fresh for the fall. We looked to the pros to say, all right, well, how did they keep things fresh? You know, how did they reboot? You know, Oprah, she would change sets at the start of each new TV season. The TV shows would get a new title sequence. I thought about getting a total makeover. And so, as you can see, none of those ambitions came through to fruition. However, we see a couple of fresh things today. Number one, I've got to thank Ray Rollins, who helped us with the new jingle, which was really cool before the show started, as well as James Bizzell, who helped us give us a new Lunch with Leaders logo, as well as the template. So I wanted to just say thanks to Ray and James, helping us keep it fresh. We've got a new look. We love it. And we've got all sorts of other things planned this fall to make sure we have the Fall is Fresh campaign. Okay. Without further ado, let's go to a couple of commercials. Youngin, welcome back. Happy September. I'm so glad you're here. Take it away with our commercials today.
Hi, Cindy. Happy September. It's great to see you. Great to have you back. We have a very special guest. And before that, just a few exciting opportunities that you won't want to miss. So first, we need more joy and laughter. And the PMX Week has just that. And they're proud to announce a virtual talent show hosted by our own stand-up comedian and orthopedic surgeon, Dr. John Kelly. So record your amazing talent and share it by September 19th and join in the fun on October 26th at 12 noon. Next up is the 30-Minute Coach. This month, we're going to talk about employee lifecycle and inform you of all the tools and resources out there to help you as an employee and manager for every step of employee experience at Penn Medicine, from recruitment, onboarding, performance management, development, offboarding, and everything in between. So don't miss it. And lastly, the book club. It's coming up. It's the end of this month with Katie Milkman. If you haven't done already, please register today, order your book by September 17th, and send me your questions for the author. And now the CMEs, make sure you have an active profile in the system linked with your name and your cell number. Text today's code, which is 73006-215-398-6728. It's open now for next 24 hours. The event handout is on the Lee Strong website. For questions, reach out directly to the CME office. Thank you and enjoy the show.
Thanks, Youngin. Appreciate all your efforts. So let's talk about today. It's going to be really good. So we thought long and hard and we wanted a big time guest and a juicy topic for our big return to live Lunch with Leaders. And I have no doubt today is going to deliver. Who's watched Survivor? I mean, if you haven't, what rock are you living under? The show's only been on the air since 1997, 40 seasons later. I'm going to stop judging. If you haven't seen, I know many of you intellectuals, you threw out your TV a long time ago. But I don't know, is it me or sometimes does it feel like sometimes organizational life feels like a reality show like Survivor? Okay, maybe without starving ourselves or the bathing suits. But there are relationships that have to be built. There's conflict. There's sometimes strategic alliances, often a lot of meetings of the tribal council, immunity, winners, losers from a resourcing perspective. You know, sometimes this is just normal way of workplace life. So there are political dynamics everywhere when people are trying to get things done, when resources are scarce and they're trying to advance themselves and their team and their agenda. Sometimes managing the politics and managing in general, it may not be the easiest or even the most fun part of our jobs as leaders, but it's really important to our skill sets and to our success. So that's going to be our topic today. How do we learn the key skills for navigating some of the organizational politics that we face? How do we keep driving innovation, especially when people see it differently than we do? How do we continue to be motivated when faced with these types of complex dynamics? So just so that for those keeping score at home and the Penn Medicine competency wonks, which I know there are some out there and we love you, today we're going to discuss five different competencies. Organizational agility, political savvy, managing ambiguity, manages conflict. I'd even throw in there self-awareness. I might even throw in there driving innovation. So maybe even six competencies. So it's a big show. And we've got a masterful leader today to share his perspective, and I'll look forward to hearing your wisdom in the chat as well. Before I introduce my guest for today's show, I want to check in with each of you. It's been a while. It's been a minute. Pull out your phones. Tell me, how you doing? What word would you say you're feeling today? What emotion are you feeling today? So using your cell phone, you're going to text Penn Medicine 918 to 22333. Once you're in the survey, give me what emotion, what one word describes how you're doing today. While you're telling me your word, let me introduce our guest today. It is my deepest honor and pleasure to introduce you to a Penn leader who probably doesn't need an introduction, Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel. He is the Vice Provost for Global Initiatives and the Co-Director of the Health Transformation Institute at the University of Pennsylvania. Zeke, you can feel free to join me on camera and on audio. Hi, I'm so glad you're here. Thank you so much for saying yes to Kevin when he asked you and for doing this. We feel really lucky. I've gotten emails all week saying, Morgan, you better not screw this up. Like, Zeke is the big time. Like, he's officially, like, big time for our little show. So thank you so much.
I don't want to correct you, but I was a little surprised when you began with the Survivor analogy. Because something you probably don't know is that I was actually the star on what we have determined to be the first competitive reality TV show predating Survivor, that Survivor was actually somehow based on. It was on the BBC. It was called Now Get Out of That. And there's actually a 10-minute clip somewhere floating in the internet about from that show. And if you watch it, what you can see is politics at the very highest level, international relations, how me, the American, gets along with the British. Let me just say, it ain't pretty.
That is a great tip, and I didn't even know, and I did some pretty good research, but boy, you scooped me on that one. Zeke, we're so happy to have you. You're joining us here from your Washington, D.C. home office studio. For those watching in the audience, you probably saw that same background just even in the last 2 weeks on either MSNBC or CNBC this summer. So I'm really hoping to channel my Andrea Mitchell inner self so I don't let you down. Casey, let's see how people are feeling today. Zeke, let's take a look at the words that our leaders are saying that they're feeling. All right, overwhelmed, excited. Ooh, I like that one. The flood. Yeah, gosh, if you're still dealing with that, just know our hearts are there for you. Happy, resigned, tired, motivated, nonstop, feeling ready. Well, maybe those things aren't together.
No, I would say this is exactly what I expected.
You did.
For two reasons. First, we're whatever, 17, 18, 19 months into the pandemic, and we're feeling drained and stressed by it. The second thing I would say is that this is probably the most stressful week for all of us, especially those with children, in the year. It's the start of school, the start of work, it's, you know, end of summer, all of that. And one of the things I did when I was department chair we didn't start work until next Monday because we wanted to give staff this period so that it was lower stress and there wasn't stress from work. Obviously, we can't start work in that same way. But I think explicitly trying to de-stress this week so people can balance their work and their life is very important to get them in the right frame of mind to hit the fall. September, October are always super busy months at work, some of the busiest. And so I like to try to ease in by not starting right after Labor Day, but giving people that week to adjust and work out the kinks in their schedule with the kids going to school and commuting and everything else changing. And so it's not no surprise to me that we see the drained, overwhelmed, but also excited. It's a new year for people. So we've got to try to, you know, at this point in the pandemic and at this point in starting a new year, make sure we boost people up.
So true. And I hope that today can inspire some of you and big shout outs to the moms and the dads and everything that you continue to do. Zeke, let's talk about you a little. Before we jump into some of your approaches to navigating complex political systems to drive innovation, let's talk about you as a leader. When you think back on your very rich career, maybe even back to your reality show guest star role, what do you think has been your most developmental experience? That maybe the one seminal moment, piece of feedback, situation, failure, where you became you, the leader you are today?
Well, I think certainly one of the most important items that I learned along the way through several experiences is to understand what was the metric of success and the metric my bosses used that would allow me to shine for them and the work that me and my team was doing to shine for them, not just to pander to them, but to understand what they thought was important and do our work in that light. So I'll just give you one story. 25 years ago, almost exactly, I was selected to be the founding chair of the Department of Bioethics at the NIH. Now, the NIH is this big behemoth biomedical research organization in Bethesda, Maryland, you know, billions of dollars in research going on there, all the different institutes, and they never had a Department of Bioethics, and I was chartered to create one. And so, you know, lots of these bioethics programs existed at other universities, and one of the things I had seen is that they were almost all marginal. And so the big challenge for me is how could I make mine central and be conceived not as a sort of marginal gotta have because, you know, the outside world, if we have a scandal, we need to show that we have the bioethicists here. But in fact, how could it be made a crown jewel, something that the leadership was proud of? And so the first thing I did is, what's the coin of the realm inside the institution? And unlike many biomedical research institutions. The NIH doesn't compete for grants, so it really isn't about the money. What it competes for are two things, and my boss made it quite clear, you know, one was training. We aim to show that we're the leading training organization in biomedical research, and you have to have an outstanding training program. And I hadn't given that much thought when I was hired. And the second is that this is a biomedical research institution, right? What they care about is publications in the leading biomedical journals. So I oriented what we did as one of the first things I said is, look, let's orient our research so that we can publish in the journals they care about. Don't orient to your specific specialty journals. Orient to getting high impact, New England Journal of Medicine, Lancet, JAMA, Science. Get our articles in those journals and make sure that we're just seen to be just as successful on the very metrics they use, not on the metrics that the peers in bioethics use. And then see if we can develop a training program that becomes the best in the world that everyone wants to emulate. Those two things are really where we focused our attention. Did it distort what we did? Absolutely not. We should be a training program to produce the next generation, and we should have high impact publications that really make a difference in the world. And one of the ways you can do that is publish in the absolute best journal, so people, and then subsequently the press also, so that it magnifies your voice. And again, so thinking about what is motivating, what will make us a crown jewel in the eyes of our leadership, rather than we have to have this and sort of toleration.
Thanks. I appreciate that. It's really concrete and very pragmatic. Figure out what the coin of the realm is in terms of the senior leaders and what they value. Let's talk conceptual. Are all systems inherently political? Like, is politics everywhere?
Politics is just another word for how humans interact. And we call it politics when there's multiple things that we have to balance. But, you know, one of the reasons we have this big forebrain, right, is because what distinguishes us is social interaction and navigating social interaction. And I think politics is just another word for how to navigate that social interaction. Some people are incredibly astute at that. They walk into a room and they can assess instantaneously, you know, who's got the power, what do they value, how are they positioning, who do they think is important. I happen to be related to one of those people. You know, I think my brother, politician, is incredibly good at that. And he instantaneously knows what the dynamics are in a room. I'm not nearly as good as he is in that. And matter of fact, I'm probably pretty poor compared to him. But what will enhance your stature in front of other people, and who are the other people that count in a room? Very, very important.
Nature nurture. Did your brother, was he born good at this? Were you born not so good at it? How have you improved, and how have you coached others to improve?
That is a great question. It's clearly a combination. He and I are different in that regard. I think we share a lot of commonalities, high energy, willing to say what's on our mind. He is much better at navigating a room, and I think I am probably better at bringing out the best in the people who work for me. He does bring out the best in people who work for him, but I incredibly long-term loyalty is one thing I value, because you know, you want to promote the people around you. But I also think some of it may have to do with birth order. I'm firstborn and he's secondborn. And part of what secondborns need to do is navigate the firstborn and figure out what's on their mind and what's going on. And so I think that probably also plays a role.
Thanks. Let me go to our audience and ask a question. How have you figured out the coin of the realm, as Zeke said, or the unwritten rules of the workplace to navigate politically? How have you sharpened your own organizational agility? Zeke, I'd love to ask you, can you give me a time where you really had to influence people who saw things very differently than you do? What were the things that you did to get them to see your perspective and maybe even change how they looked at it?
That is also a great question. You know, I would say that if there's a theme to the work I've done over the last 35 years, it is the theme of if there's a conventional wisdom, I'm usually not for it. I'm usually against it. So I'm spend a lot of time trying to convince people that what they're thinking and what they're believing is not right, and that they need to see things from a different perspective. So one of the things I think, again, is very important is to begin by establishing some common framework and some common metric by which the analysis or the data or the world is going to be evaluated. And then try to show that my understanding of that metric is better than their understanding of that metric, or that my understanding is, while maybe not going to be the right one for this very moment, is coming on. It's where the world is moving to. And so one of the things I especially try to do is to, again, suss out what other people take and accept as the right things. You know, I already mentioned, you know, high impact publications that really change the way people analyze the world. I do think one of my talents, as it were, is to create frameworks for understanding the world that are easily transmitted to other people. Here are the things you need to take into account, and give a list that everyone said after they see the list says, oh yes, that's right. And so I think that's super important. And then I try to show how, you know, my view of the world, this list is, which you've now accepted, this is how that list either gets realized or where we're failing on the list, etc. And so I try to first establish some common ground and then show how this analysis is more in line with that shared framework that we have all agreed is the right framework or the right set of values or the right goals.
Thanks. So it sounds like you're intentionally provocative quite often to get people to think differently about the future. When do you find that that strategy doesn't work? And maybe it's like the Hamilton or the Burr advice to Hamilton, talk less, smile more works best. Like, how do you know when to lean in to be provocative or when to stay quiet and let others put their stuff out there for you to be most impactful?
Well, I think that's actually something that's grown with age. And, you know, one of the important things I have certainly learned over the last decade is to shut up and let other people talk and let other people say what they think is important and what they think is going to, you know, what's going to be necessary. And then try to think through, all right, if that's where they think things are going, what more can I add or what more are they missing that we can bring to the table? And I think that's a very, you know, letting other people talk, you know, should be very important to you because it's information gathering about what's in someone else's mind and the way they're thinking about the world. And one of the things I have noticed is that people who tend to be very effective, especially in this political realm, do tend to let other people show their cards, as it were, and then work with, okay, this is where they think they're going. Either you agree or don't agree, but what can you add on that will advance items or, you know, things that are happening? I'll tell you another, this is a Penn story.
Please.
You know, one of the things I learned about Penn early on, and this is not by any means meant to be an insult, but we have a somewhat inferiority complex at Penn. And we're always asking, or my experience, certainly at the university, always asking, what is Harvard doing or Yale doing or Princeton doing or and Stanford? And it always confused me. It's like, well, why are we looking at that? I've been at those institutions. They make mistakes all the time. Why are we looking to them for the right action? One of the things I began to understand is I can use that to my advantage. So one of the things I did was to say, you know, when we go out and recruit, we're going to highlight when we're recruiting someone who was trained at those institutions or is on faculty at those institutions, or we're competing with those institutions and we win the competition and attract them to Penn and show them that Penn is more desirable. And so, you know, I won't say the only people we recruit are from those institutions, but sure. I do make it a point that, you know, this person, you know, whatever, trained at the Brigham and now we've got them as a faculty member, or was at the on the faculty at Mass General and now we have them at Penn. And I think that actually turns out to be very, very important. It's not important. I mean, the most important thing, get really talented people. But get really talented people from institutions that we highly value as our competition, that actually is seen to be even more valuable. And I think, again, understanding how other people value things and when it doesn't conflict with your realizing a goal or actually can add to it is very, very important.
Thanks. Our audience really agrees with you. They said asking colleagues for advice, developing relationships, more listening, less talking, mentors who really listen more than talk, a lot of listening, finding mentors, asking experts, knowing your resources, lots of observation, knowing what makes people tick, really in line with some of your comments. So one of the things that our leaders most often ask me for support with is having difficult conversations and managing conflict. And if I can remember sitting in my apartment in Hoboken, New Jersey in 2008, this is long before I was even in academic medicine, and watching you and your brothers on Charlie Rose. And I remember you joking that dinner was like an intense like time and you were happy if no one bled or if you weren't called an idiot, like that was just par for the course at your dinner table growing up. Fast forward, when you're in conflict, does this keep you up at night? Does it like grapple with your insides, or just growing up, Dr. Emmanuel, like you don't worry about that? Like what advice do you have for managing conflict and the stress of these politics? Because, you know, sometimes it can really eat people alive.
Well, I'm no different. Sometimes it can eat people alive. But I, first of all, personally, I have a pretty thick skin because of those dinner conversations. As I like to say to people, you can't say anything bad to me that my brothers haven't already said to me and multiple times. And so I don't take it personally. And I think that's pretty important survival skill. When people are screaming at you, you know, it's not personal. There's something else going on. I think difficult conversations, it's not helpful. I have not found it helpful to yell. And I would say two things. First of all, when people who work for me screw up, I don't yell at them. A good boss takes responsibility for the team. You are responsible for the team. If something screws up, it's your job, right? And the team appreciates that. You can tell them, you know, this didn't go well. You guys didn't do this, but it's very, very important that you take the responsibility for that and work to fix things. I would say a second thing I do is try to find out from people what's going on. I don't know, 6, 8, 9 months ago in the midst of someone quit or wanted to quit or told me he was quitting. And I was like, what's going on? Why is this? And, you know, I got a very interesting story of work-life balance that was out of whack because he had kids and it was getting tough. And his boss being very demanding and a bit insensitive to that work-life balance and the overwhelming work burden that he was experiencing. And it's like, well, can we work this out? Rather than you quitting, let's figure out how we can work this out. And again, part of this is I didn't have that piece of information. I didn't have that conflict. And I knew that that conflict wasn't, you know, his boss was probably stressed out too about coming deadlines and needed his input critically. It wasn't a sign that she was pissed at him. It was a sign of how important he was to the organization. And so working that out between them wasn't too complicated, helped retain a critical employee. And so I think trying to figure out if there's something that can be done. Now, sometimes there's nothing that can be done. You know, person thinks they've gotten a better opportunity. You want to end on a good note. One of the things I've always noted is, you know, people, when they leave McKinsey, right, it's always on a positive note. And no, even if McKinsey wanted them to go, it's on a positive note. You never know when those people are going to be important to you again, be in a different role, etc. And, you know, there's probably a different role that for someone who's not doing well, who, where they can actually flourish. There are few people I find who are really toxic and you don't want to be around them at all because they're not contributing. They're always negative or undermining constantly. I've had some of those employees and it's quite painful, especially in, you know, big institutions. It's often hard to fire someone and they can be quite painful in the times that they're there. And I think, again, being frank with other people is really, really important about where the stress is coming from, what's going on, what your reaction is, and what you're going to do about it.
Thanks. I really appreciate first your humanness, because I'm glad to hear you have some of the same problems that I do as a leader and many of those watching today, as well as the thought around being real direct with people in a fair way so you can put out there what it is you need. One of the things I like most about you is your energy and you're passionate about what you believe in. What happens when you're fighting for something that you really believe in and relationships are really in the balance? How and when do you compromise? And can you give me an example of a time where you had to compromise and it felt like everyone was still winning? Like, is that possible at this point? Or sometimes when you compromise, everyone feels like they lose. Can you give me any insight into some of your experience with that?
Well, actually, let me back up and everyone who's in a leadership position faces circumstances where it seems like things aren't going well, where you have to choose between the right and ethical thing to do and getting along with others. And I think it's really important that you end up choosing the ethical thing to do and take the long-term perspective. It is really important that you get a reputation of doing the right thing for people and doing the right thing by your people and not compromising. I've had a number over the course of my career, a number of cases where people were coming down on either me or some of my colleagues. And there was a right thing to do. And if I backed down on that, I would compromise my ethics and feel horrible. And if I stood up, at least in some cases, I could have been fired and really lost my job and endangered lots of things through that. One of the things I have learned over time, and ironically, probably the most important mentor on this to me has been Tony Fauci. When I was at the NIH, is just do the right thing. The important thing is to do the right thing. The world may not like it, but it'll come back to be your benefit. You will get a reputation of the person who is telling the truth. You can't be compromised, has a spine of steel when it comes to the right thing. And again, you are right. It can be antagonistic. Again, one of the things I try to do to take the sting out of those kind of conflicts is to find what's the common element, all right? I'll give you some of you may remember, some of you may have about the same kind of gray hair I do, but in the early 2000s, I think it was, there was a scandal at the NIH over a researcher who had some financial dealings with Pfizer, which you should never have if you're a government employee. And then there was this big crackdown on conflict of interest rules. All of us have experienced the consequence of that crackdown. But it was even worse for the government employees. One of the things that the original proposed rules had was that researchers and no one on staff could hold any stock in any healthcare organization. Now, I happen to have done a lot of work on conflict of interest and thought through a lot of conflict of interest, and that just was an overbroad rule. And one of the things I did is to say, listen, we don't want conflicts of interest. We agree with the administration. We don't want to have people where financial motives are clouding their judgment. But this overbroad rule is the wrong way to reach it and is going to make good people leave and compromise the NIH. And so, again, I tried to establish, let's get what's common, what we agree to, and show them that what we were doing was actually inimical to those very values that we had all agreed, or goals we all agreed were important. And, you know, that didn't necessarily endear me because it was turned out to be embarrassing for the administration. But it did do several things. First of all, it got the right rules in the end. And second of all, it endeared me to my peers, the fellow researchers at the NIH who saw this as really wrong. And I said, look, what we want to do is constrain the financial holdings. You can't have financial holdings in something you're doing a research project in, or that might distort a judgment related to a research project. So if you're working on a drug and you can't have an investment in the company that makes a drug, you can't have an investment in a company that has an alternative to the drug. That's clear. But, you know, some insurance company, that's irrelevant to this. All right. So, again, part of the goal is to find something which is common. We all have this goal. Let's realize it better. That doesn't necessarily mean things will be smooth, right? People don't like to be shown to be wrong. And you have to try to give them an out. That I may not be very good at.
I mean, that's my next line of questioning is, there's no doubt in my mind that, like us, you've probably worked with some pretty big egos, bullies, gatekeepers, narcissists, blockers of change. And if you can't find that common ground, how have you dealt with some of these folks? Any advice for us?
Then you just have to appeal to whatever the court of judgment is. If the court of judgment is, look, here's how we're advancing the goal, and you're getting that person's boss, or you're getting the board of trustees, or whoever it is, you have to show that you are right, and that, you know, this is actually going to be, again, undermine the collective goal and the long-term view. A lot of this, Cindy, I think what you're hinting at is a lot of this is immediate versus long-term. And again, for the organization, try to get your ego out of it and show how it's important for the organization.
Thanks. I appreciate that. Dr. Mike Parmasek, our chair of medicine, has given me some coaching before, and he said, you got to play poker. And sometimes in poker, it looks like you're losing, but you're playing the long game in poker and you're playing to win. So I can appreciate that.
Is that the sign of a misspent youth, Cindy?
I'm sure he's like a gambler on the underneath side of his great demeanor. So congratulations. We were all so pen proud when it came to your nomination to be a member of the COVID-19 task force under President Biden and his incoming administration. So give us an inside perspective. What were some of the toughest decisions that you had to make? What do you think? Did you get any new learnings or insights from that experience as a leader yourself? Well, what's it like to be you on that group?
Well, first of all, A, it was a great honor, and B, just a tremendous set of peers who I first, many of them I knew before, but respected and appreciated their deep understanding and also different perspective from what I have. You know, people who knew the FDA quite well, people who were working in different areas. Again, one of the important things is to figure out where you can contribute, what my value added was, and to try to make that contribute to the overall success. So, for example, one of the things I had some focus on and was really working on was the sort of therapeutics, the fact that we weren't really developing therapeutics, that our therapeutic effort was fragmented and very divided. We weren't actually doing all that well in thinking through a coherent strategy for developing therapeutics clinically and testing them quite rapidly, and pointing out that the British had done a much better job of doing that and try to outline what we could do to make it more effective. And not, you know, just because there were so many things to do, not that many people were interested in that. I'd say another thing, frankly, which I saw, you know, early in March and April of 2020, that was going to be a huge problem, was the whole issue of allocating resources. It was quite clear to me, literally in the midst of the opening of the first infections, I actually happened to be in Norway in early March giving a presentation there. And on the plane back, you know, everyone was worried about surges in New York City. Everyone was worried about shortages of PPE, shortages of ventilators. And it occurred to me, this is a fundamental ethical problem. This is an area I have expertise in. I brought together a group of people to think through, all right, what does ethics say about this? How can we guide clinicians who are on the front line? We wrote a piece, you know, in about 24 hours that was ended up in the New England Journal. And then we looked at the bigger issue, the allocation of vaccines. We assembled another big group of ethicists from many different countries and looked at the allocation of vaccines around the world and between countries. That has been, I would say, you know, it's not the only view. The WHO has a different view, but it's been quite influential because it's a burning question, and we could bring to bear, I think, the best skills in the world on it that were unique to Penn. Knowing or building, like we've all learned from the mRNA vaccines and Penn's role in them, building on past work and a history, decades of thinking about this, very, very important in the midst of a crisis. You can't really invent things in the midst of a crisis. What you can do is use the resources you've developed over time and apply them to the crisis. And that, I think, was a very important lesson for me. Use the resources I had. I was particularly had developed over time and kind of uniquely positioned, and uniquely positioned to bridge the world of bioethics as well as biomedicine to bring to bear the best of both sides.
Thanks. We just put the link to your article for fair allocations of resources in the chat so we can have our audience read it. So one of our physician leaders wants to know, physician leader to physician leader, how do you think it's best for some of our physician leaders to navigate the complex new world of COVID and healthcare politics? Any advice?
I think part of the issue is, you know, everyone wants this to end. You know, you've heard the phrase over and over again, you know, I'm done with COVID. It doesn't work that way. Your being done is not helpful. The second thing, again, is try to figure out what the right thing to do is at any moment. You know, over the summer, we did have a brief window. Infections were coming down. We hadn't seen Delta yet. And it was able to ease up. I think going back to fundamentals is absolutely critical. This is not a normal time. You know, I teach a class of 150 students in a small auditorium. People are, you know, shoulder to shoulder, chair to chair. You know, we have to insist. I insist you all wear N95 masks. We're bringing in filters to make sure we have the best ventilation possible. And, you know, we are trying to do the right thing. Being nimble and flexible, and being nimble and flexible with your staff is going to be critical. They're also burned out. They're also overwhelmed, as the emotions at the start. And I think recognizing that, affirming that you're in the same position, and that all of this is new to everyone in the world, right? The last time we had a big pandemic was 100 years ago. None of us were around. So we've got to be flexible. We're going to be flexible with schedules. We're going to be flexible with work environment. Where do we go? And we are going to adapt and be sure that you, our employees, are safe. And I think having that message is you get the best out of your workers. I will tell you, I'll just give you one thing. Over the summer, I talked to my administrative staff and I said, listen, we're all overwhelmed. You guys are running as hard as I am. Why don't you figure out a day? Each one of you can take an extra day a week. You'll work 4 days. You'll be off 3 days, but we'll have full coverage. So I won't be left high and dry. That'll keep your work-life balance right. And when you're on and you won't feel like you're compromising your obligations to your family or whatever. Understanding their situation and giving them permission to structure things, as long as this is important, we've got to have full coverage, you know, some media request comes in late or some, you know, something else that is urgent, there's someone there to help me, really important. And that I think helps. That I think also, Cindy, gets me to another management rule I have, please, which is really important to communicate. When I'm managing my teams, and now I have one big team and one relatively smaller team, I think it's really, really important to hire good people and not to micromanage them. I am like the worst micromanager there is, and I don't like to micromanage people. I like to hire people and say, here's the job we've got. You can come to me anytime you have questions or issues or help. And you're going to structure things and you're going to be empowered to make decisions. I think you get so much better. I mean, there are some people who don't like to lead and don't like to stick their neck out, but most people, they like autonomy. We don't like to be told what to do. We like to be told what's the task and let's figure out how to get there. And, you know, as long as your door is open, they know they can come in and ask for advice. I think that's way the best strategy than micromanaging. And people who feel like they're not in control if they're not micromanaging, I think end up compromising the quality of work, because the best people, they don't like to be micro. None of us like to be micromanaged.
No.
Right? We like to know what is expected of us and then say, all right, we trust you to do the good job.
Thanks. I appreciate your candor and your self-reflection. And it leads me to my next question. Do you have a mentor? Have you worked with an executive coach? How have you sharpened your skills so you're not micromanaging or you're not talking more than listening? Some of these things that you've mentioned are developmental opportunities for you. How have you continued to hone your own leadership chops?
That's a great question. And Cindy, I think a lot of people, especially when they get to leadership positions, think, well, I'm the leader now. I got here. I don't need that coach. And someone told me this, and I'm sure you guys but you know, the absolute most elite athletes have coaches, right?
Right.
They're the best in the world, and they still have coaches who can tell them, tweak this, do that, do the others. And one of the lucky things I've had is great mentors all through my career. I've had mentors on my writing, you know, do this. I've had three incredibly important mentors. You know, the most important mentor was my first master's thesis advisor in Oxford, who says, you know, short sentences, no more than 10 words, and just have short sentences. Very, very important advice to me. I write much better with short sentences, long, convoluted Henry James sentences. Not me. Don't do it. It's a lot easier to be clear with short sentences. And then I've had people, and I mentioned Tony Fauci as one. He's certainly been one of the mentors. Who's do the right thing. When you feel like you're conflicted between doing the ethical thing and doing something else for expediency, stick with the right thing, because that is going to serve you in the long run. You have a reputation, and if you're going to have a 30, 40, 50-year career, that reputation is all you got. So you want to make sure it's the right reputation. I also, you know, I have another mentor who's like 96 now. You know, one of the things he told me is, you know, polish, polish, polish. Think about it. Yes, the last little bit, it's going to annoy you. It takes a lot of work. But actually, that little burnishing the chrome, it makes it much better for other people to hear. So figure out the phrase that will capture other people. You know, don't be afraid to adjust things once again. Edit, constantly refine things was basically the message. And don't think things are done. Think of everything as in process. And I'll say that I have one last item that has really been, I have, 20 irons in the fire at any one time. Projects we're thinking about, projects that we've begun, and a lot of them never ignite. And it looks like wasted energy, but four or five of them will ignite, and that's the path we'll take. Either they'll ignite because, the collaboration is working, the moment has arisen, we anticipated it, everyone wants this advice at this moment, and we happen to be in the right position, or some data set has fallen on us and we can actually answer this pivotal question. Having more projects going, but only doing some of them at the right moment, very, very important, because it's hard to anticipate what is going to be critical. And that's not wasted effort. And don't think of it as wasted effort. It's part of the, those of you who know about clinical research, all these phase 1 trials that only, 50% of them get to phase 2 and only, 10% of those go on, right? You have to have a big stockpile of things you're working on to get the ones to maturity. And that's just the way it is. You don't have all the variables when you start.
Thanks. I appreciate that. I feel like we could go on for another hour because you've been so interesting. I want to ask you this last question, and maybe you can answer me in a minute or less. So what's next for you in your career? You've kind of done it all. What can we look forward to seeing from you? What are you excited about?
So one of the things I've been focused on for the last few years is really scalable reforms around physicians. Problems with academics is we tend to do, here's a change, or we evaluate someone else's change, and then we look at a change, and it's good for one institution, but it's not scalable. And I think one of the big things, especially now that we're, a big health system, 5 hospitals, thousands of physicians, is we need scalable changes. We don't need changes that are good for a small group. We need to think about how are we going to make this change that can go across our system, and not just our system, but improve the whole system, because after all, we are an academic center, and part of what we want to do is impact the whole, not just American healthcare system, other healthcare systems. And so one of the things I spend a lot of time now thinking about is how do we impact physician behavior? Because we're the critical links, us doctors, in terms of caring for patients, making sure that healthcare systems are working. And how do we impact that at a way that can be scaled when we find the right ones? And then when we're scaling, also simultaneously refining, because the first, the second, the third iteration is going to be okay, but we're going to have to constantly be improving and adapting as we scale. So that's what I'm doing. We're working on trying to change physician payment, change how physicians navigate the system for their patients. I'll be doing that. And I'm thinking of some of the bigger messages and lessons I've learned. Like one of the things I think is super important that I'm going to take beyond medicine is we have a complex system. Simplicity is a virtue. And we don't do enough to focus in on simplicity. How do we do more to make things simpler, not more complicated? And we tend to lay around programs and programs rather than say, oh, can we step back and peel away some of this, make it simple, and get back to a system that people can navigate and use more easily. And so that's one topic that I'm thinking a lot about these days.
I love it. I think we can all kind of think about that too, especially because COVID has been such a reckoning. How can we simplify as much as possible? I want to say thank you so much for all the great insights and tips. Truly, it's been remarkable. Let me do a few plugs for you, because who doesn't want more Dr. Emmanuel in our lives? First, Zeke runs a professional development course called Transforming Healthcare Delivery with Penn Medicine Ethics and Health Policy Online Education. The course, which you may be interested in, Principles of Healthcare Transformation, Transforming Electronic Health Records, and Implementation of Other Innovative Practices. Zeke is also a prolific author. Here are four books that we wanted to plug out of probably 15 or more that he has either authored or edited: Reinventing American Healthcare, Prescription of the Future, The $1 trillion Revolution, and Which Country Has the World's Best Healthcare? Zeke, I just want to say thanks so much. We're all cheering for you. Hashtag pen proud. And thank you for all you're doing to change healthcare in the United States and beyond the front lines during the COVID crisis. Thank you for being my guest today.
Thank you, Cindy. It's been a wonderful pleasure. And I hope it's been useful to the audience.
Thank you. So I hope the audience will continue to tune in. Before we go to the next show, I wanted to say one of our other ways that we're keeping it fresh is our credits. Obviously, I'm not doing this all by myself. So I wanted to just say thank you so much to our core production crew. Some of the members you could see there, we have Victor helping us, our IT guru who's helping us today. We couldn't do it without all of you. So here's the next set of shows because we've got an awesome fall plan. So our next show is on September 23rd, The Adaptable Leader Now. We're going back 1 year later, Dr. Driscoll, Fran Johnston, who you know from Telios Institute and the CNO of Princeton Healthcare, Sheila Kemp. And we're going to talk about what does it mean to lead now and how do we keep up our adaptability 18 months in when people are tired. Also, the world is changing. The world is changing in healthcare, especially around value-based care. We'll have our experts, Roy Schwartz, Mitch Schnall, and Matt Press here on October 7th to ensure that we're all ready and ready to keep up with the new face of healthcare. Add the Outlook series to your calendar. You could see the Lunch with Leaders dates, October 21, November 4, November 18th, December 2nd, and December 16th. You won't want to miss it. And remember, if you haven't seen any of these back episodes, they're new to you. So everything, including this, will be on the Lead Strong website. I hope you'll help us get the word out there. I just wanted to say in closing, thank you so much to each of you. I know you're juggling so much, especially this week. Zeke's so right. Like, this is a tough week and you still showed up. So I wanted to thank you for continuing to be the intentional leaders that you are. You inspire me to be me. I'm hoping that you continue to take good care of yourselves and your team so we can come together, be in community, and continue to get a lot of things done here this fall. And you're really making a difference. So thanks so much for spending some time with me today, and I'll look forward to seeing you again.